Peggy, what can you remember about your first drink?
I would say my very first drink, I remembered not liking the taste. It was a baby sham. And it was, I found it very bitter. I found it bitter. Nevertheless, I felt obliged to drink it, you know. And I don't know where that came from, whether that was a social thing. Everybody else was drinking their drink, so I drank it. But I also remember feeling the effect of it very, very quickly. And not feeling in control.
Do you know the number of people I've spoken to, Peggy, who, when they first tasted alcohol, didn't really like it much?
No.
It's incredible, isn't it? And yet people go on to drink it and almost get used to the taste of it rather than enjoy it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I really didn't like the taste. And more importantly, I didn't like the feeling out of control, feeling I wasn't drunk from the first mouthful, but there was something about it that wasn't making me feel very secure, if that makes sense.
Definitely, and, that almost giddiness, yeah, or that like otherworldliness.
That's it. That's a good word, that giddiness, yeah.
How old would you have been, Peggy, at this point?
I think I would say I'd be 16, 17.
Okay.
Yeah, and drinking underage in a pub.
Well, as many people did, to be fair.
We did. Well, it's something, you know, that we did. We went in pubs and socialised and drank the alcohol.
I suspect we've all done it, Peggy. Now then.
Yeah.
So, you're there. So far, so average. You've had a drink of baby sham. Didn't really care for it much. Didn't really like the effect. So, how did that inform your drinking going forward? What did you get into? What was your weapon of choice?
Right, okay. Well, what I actually got into, really, was at that time, I was a cadet nurse working in a local hospital for people with mental health problems. It was a huge hospital in North Manchester. And I went on to do nurse training. And, of course, the social aspects of being in the nursing profession and being in the medical profession, the social aspects became very, very much a part of our job, if you know what I mean. You know, we worked hard and we played hard. We socialised a lot. It just became habitual, really.
I do think nurses are known for enjoying a drink, and I don't say that pejoratively.
Absolutely.
But given how hard nurses work, I don't blame anybody for wanting to let their head down. So you were in a crowd of people, you worked hard, you played hard, you went out, you enjoyed a drink. Now, a lot of people are able to do that and nurse a hangover.
Yeah.
The day after, and you know, get on with life, and maybe they won't drink again for a long while or whatever. Other people don't have that sort of light switch, you know, where some people can turn the drinking off and on. Some people seem to have trouble with that light switch. And I guess the question would be, when did you realise that you were perhaps drinking a little more than you should, or?
Well, many, many years later, I have to say, because I then went on to do my nurse training and I qualified. And ironically, the first job I had as a qualified nurse was on a regional alcohol treatment unit. And it was for people from all over the Northwest region who had undergone the detox part, so the physical addiction wasn't there anymore, and they came to our unit, which was a post-detox unit. And I think, I really believe that at that point, I learned an awful lot more from the people who came through our unit, who, you know, who shared their stories and their experiences. And I do believe that it put me off to a degree, in the sense that there were like warning signs that, that I was identifying with some of the people. And so I was aware that drinking to the extent that we did in the social setting really wasn't the best thing to do. And so, for a lot of years, that helped me, and I could very easily stay abstinent, and I would often be the driver, you know, the designated driver. Because I found that easier. Total abstinence for me at that point was much easier than having one, because it never stopped at one. And of course, I knew that was a danger sign.
So you were talking to people who had been through detox, and what they were saying were chiming with your lifestyle. You were thinking, hey, oh, there's a bit of me in this.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And the thing I remember more than anything was that when I did drink, I was always ill. I was always, and my colleagues used to laugh about it, because I used to say, look, I'm not drunk, I'm just physically unwell. But I always was physically sick. So I was the first to, you know, I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop at one. And I would drink to the point where I was, you know, incapable of enjoying the rest of the evening because I was being sick.
And yet there were times that you were able to be completely abstinent. And
absolutely.
So given that you didn't really like the taste of alcohol in the beginning, and there were periods of time, and it made you ill, and there were periods of time when you could stay off it altogether, it'd seem an easy fix to a lot of people to think, well, I don't like it, it makes me ill, and I don't have to do it. And, you know, that's where I suppose the illness comes into it, doesn't it?
It does, because whilst I was able at that point in my life, I did exercise an amount of control. But at some stage in my life, alcohol took on a different kind of meaning, and it became a part of my life and part of everyday living in the home. We had drink in the home. We entertained people in the home. That became a social event, and my drinking took on, a more regular, habitual, not so much out of control and being sick now, but I'd actually got increased tolerance. I was starting to be able to drink more without being ill, and slowly the drink was taking over, and eventually I no longer had the choice of whether to not drink or drink. I reached a point where I could not stop, despite the fact that I wanted to. I knew I needed to, but couldn't.
All around us in society, drink is pressed as an answer to a lot of questions. You drink to celebrate, or you drink to commiserate sometimes. If you got the job, you celebrate. If you don't get the job, you commiserate and all the rest of it. And social occasions, it's a glass of bubbly or it's a beer with the lads or all that kind of thing. And for a great many people, that's absolutely fine. There's no problem. It's almost like we're pressured to drink in a funny way, isn't it? Like it's what you do.
Yeah, it is. And yet, for me, and with hindsight, of course, and the beauty of being part of a beautiful fellowship that can allow you to become well. You know, I when I look back, I can see the level of denial that was going on in my life, where I was justifying drinking. When you say it's part of your life, well, it is. It can be. And then you make sure it is. So that an example I give is that at mealtimes, you know, we had regular mealtimes, despite the fact that we had busy working lives. We never missed, as a family, me and my husband and my daughter, we never missed our mealtimes. It was an important part of the family life. But we never had basic meals. For example, we didn't have beans on toast or egg and chips. We always had to have gourmet meals that you can put wine with, because wine don't really go with egg and chips, does it?
Well, not overly, does it? No, to be
no.
fair. Yeah.
So that our life became, you know, around the dining table, and if it wasn't somebody celebrating the birthday or some celebration of some sort, then it would be, well, we'll invite friends round for a meal. We'll invite family round for a meal. And more I realised that was me engineering that, you know, as...
creating excuses, perhaps.
Creating situations that justified, allowed drinking to be part and parcel of everyday life. Yeah,
well, that's
definitely.
Really interesting. Talk to me about the kind of toolkit that an alcoholic would have to try and, you know, ensure, give a reason for drink, or to get their hands on a beer.
Oh, well, basically anything. You know, any reason. The sun shining today, for example, that would be one where, oh, well, we'd get the sun chairs out and we'd get the outdoor cooking thing out and we'd barbecue and we'd party outside. So,
and naturally a beer comes out, or a bottle of wine or whatever.
So,
okay.
Yeah. Holidays became a huge part of our lives. You know, having to, because going on holiday, you could drink every day. Sometimes you could, I mean, if your flight was at 6 o'clock in the morning, you could still have your drink, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning.
I've seen people
do it. You wouldn't dream of doing that normally. But yeah. Of course, so holidays were important, meals were important, anything that allowed for drink to be had without fingers pointing, you know, like, ooh, what are you doing? You shouldn't be drinking at this time of day.
Did anybody, Peggy, ever have a word with you or suggest to you, you're caning it a bit, aren't you? You're drinking a bit more. Did anyone ever raise the question of how much you were drinking?
No, I would say, ultimately, people, my family noticed. But, you know, I was a great one for leading that double life, that having the standards of I was a professional nurse, you know, I was in senior positions, I had a lot of responsibility. And on the surface, you know, and even within the family, it was, oh, if you've got a problem, oh, Peggy will help you out, and she knows what to do. And so I was very much held in high esteem, and people didn't know. And of course, I was under tremendous pressure and tension, because deep down I knew behind the scenes that I was drinking, and that my drinking was more than just a habit, you know. And I feared as well, because I had the knowledge, and so I knew deep down, you know, that I had a problem. But I was constantly trying to control it. And I guess that's why my life revolved around alcohol. Always at the centre. It was always at the centre. Somewhere, alcohol was there daily. for many years. For many years. Yeah, definitely.
I want to know how long it was from you deep down knowing that you had an issue to getting some help for it, and what the catalysts were, what caused you after that length of time to get help.
I would say that I went to the point of getting help was on the 21st of December 2006. And at that point, I'd believed, you know, in all honesty, that I'd been drinking every single day, battling with it every day, saying to myself, I'm not going to drink today, I'm going to have an alcohol-free day. But as soon as I got in from work, it was the first thing I did. And I couldn't stop until I was fast asleep and ready to go to bed. And then up the next day facing work. So I would say at that point, I believed I'd been drinking to that extent for five years when I went to AA in 2006. I can't tell you what occurred, except there was nothing really changed, except I woke up one morning of that day in December, and I just felt I didn't want a cup of tea. The first thing in my head was a whiskey.
Did that frighten you?
Very much. Very much so. And and I remember that was the day I rang the helpline in Manchester, the AA helpline. And I don't either. I think I was probably... I'd probably drunk a bottle of whiskey by the time I rang them. And the guy answered and took me details, and then a very lovely lady rang me. She rang me back, and that was it. And that evening, my family were coming up for a meal, and I just was in Norfolk State to serve them, and you know. And that really was the first time that my family had seen me in such a bad state, in a state where they didn't know what was happening. They were shocked, really, in a way, because even though they knew we were heavy drinkers, you know, it was, I think the word alcoholic and going to Alcoholics Anonymous didn't enter their heads, really.
It's such a stark word, isn't it, alcoholic? It's such a difficult thing.
Absolutely, yeah. And I seem to remember, I think it was my husband said, what have you rung them for? And it was like, but that was, I just think that was because I'd hidden the pressures and the amount of drinking I was drinking. I'd hidden it so well from people.
So it kind of came as a surprise to them.
A little bit. Even though, you see, for them, the alcohol was something they could take it or leave it. So the fact that we were, alcohol was a big part of our life, it wasn't the be all and end all for them. So it was a shock. It was only me that was the one who was, you know, obsessing about making sure we got alcohol and making sure we were able to drink acceptably, so to speak. So yeah, I think they were shocked.
So at some point you attended your first AA meeting, and I'm curious to know what that's like. Can you talk to us about what you were feeling when you went in, you know, after walking up to the door for that first meeting?
Yeah, it was, I felt like it was the worst day of my life. I really did. Even though I knew I needed to be there, and I knew it was the place to go from my own professional knowledge, I knew it was where I needed to be and where I had the best chance of recovering. I still had that horrible feeling that this was the worst thing that could have happened to me. Even though I had every sympathy and empathy with all other people who I'd looked after, you know, from a nursing perspective, when it came to me, I couldn't. I genuinely felt like that was the worst day of my life.
So you got through the door. Nevertheless, you went in. You remained true to yourself. And what did you find inside?
I found absolutely love oozing out of everybody. Everybody were focused on me. It being my first meeting, and everyone was sharing their own experience of their drinking, where it took them, how they'd come into AA, how well they were now, what the difference in their life from reaching out for help from AA. And it was just overwhelming, really. It was overwhelming.
How quickly? I mean, you felt that love, and you felt instantly accepted there. How long did it take you to work out that, yeah, actually, this is me. This is brilliant.
Yeah. Well, my journey in AA, to be absolutely honest, to take on every single bit of AA and everything it had to offer was a long journey for me. From that 2006, I was able to stay sober for 2.5 years after that.
Brilliant.
But the thing the very first thing when you go to AA is, the first step is, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable. And I had tremendous difficulty with that step because I had this ability to rationalise and justify and make everything appear, you know, perfect on the surface. And
well, you'd use a practice by the sound of it.
Yeah. And it was just like, I could not do that surrender. You know, you've got to fully concede to your innermost self that deep down, you know, you've had it with alcohol. You cannot do anything about it. But of course, I'd been full of motivation, determination. I had a dynamic personality, all of that. But it got in the way of my recovery because, you know, I couldn't take it on board 100% that first step.
Okay. So after 2.5 years?
I had the lurking notion that maybe it wasn't that bad. Maybe, you know, I could just have one or two drinks.
So presumably you had one.
That's what I did. And of course, very quickly, you know, within days, I was worse than ever, because the nature of the disease is it is progressive.
Mm.
And, you know, one thing we can guarantee as an alcoholic speaking to another alcoholic, if you continue to drink, once you've lost that control, you never get it back, ever. And so any notion that you can control your drinking and enjoy it like you either used to or like other people can, that notion's got to be smashed. You just can't do it. But of course, you know, I kept thinking it being, it was something my dad always said to me when I was little. He used to say, do you know, he said, you will not be told you. It was like I always had an answer, and I always said, yeah, but what about such a thing?
Yeah.
And it was like that with alcohol. It was like, no, there's got to be another solution to this. There's got to be a way that I can drink again without it messing me, you know, messing me up to the degree it does.
And you weren't looking for it.
I hung on to that for a long time. And, you know, people around me in AA, my beautiful friends, would say, oh, she's off again. And it got to the point where, you know, I'd have a year's sobriety and then I'd be off again. And it wasn't until I finally conceded fully and did all the work that was needed to be done, all the steps, got a sponsor, did everything that everybody said I needed to do. And then from then on, and I did that in 2018, and I haven't had a drink since.
Wonderful. That's really good. Tell me this. A lot of people think drunks, you see them on park benches or you see them in doorways or they're delinquents and all the rest of it. But, you know, you and I and a lot of people would know that you don't have to be a delinquent to be a drunk. And I'm guessing in the many meetings you'll have attended over the years, you'll have seen all sorts of people battling that very same disease. Some, you know, from some in high places, some in low places. What kind of people would you have met along the way?
I've met everybody.
All walks of life.
Everybody, all walks of life, human beings who, you know, one way or another, alcohol has taken over their life and the obsession, you know, to find that drink, to continue to drink despite the damage, the pain, all of that that it causes. You know, it's an age-old public health and psychosocial problem, isn't it? But, you know, it's it knows no barriers and it crosses all positions.
Rich and poor alike.
Rich, poor, man, woman. And, you know, even though I functioned very well for a long time, despite being an alcoholic, being a, what many people call as a functioning alcoholic, for me, that was just me in denial. Yes, I was functioning. Yes, I had a house. Yes, I had a job. I did all of those things. But, you know, eventually, my last drink, I was homeless. You know, I'd lost everything.
So your career, your house, everything.
Everything.
Can I ask how you came to be homeless?
Well, basically, my family and just couldn't put up with me anymore. They couldn't bear seeing me in the states I was in. And I just used to make such bad decisions when I'd been drinking. My life was unmanageable in the end, and it took everything from me, you know. And, you know, in the end, I had a house in the south of France that we were having to sell because of financial difficulties, you know, and some of, the majority of that was because of me not functioning properly and making, you know, bad decisions along the way. So I had a house in the south of France we had to sell. So we were back in this country living with family. But of course, when I relapsed for the last time, I just had to leave. I had to leave them. Unfortunately, there was someone, a relative, who was working away and just said, look, go to my house. And that's where I stayed for a week. And of course, the beauty of having been in AA was, Gary, that I was able, I knew what I needed to do. I knew that there was a solution. I knew that I could get recovery. So somehow or other, I'd almost built some resilience in there, and I got to the doctors, and I got him to give me a community detox, and and I haven't looked back since then.
It was a bumpy flight. It was a bumpy road.
Oh, it was absolutely. You know, and all the people in AA who've seen me through my journey, you know, it was like, oh, for goodness sake, she's off again. You know, and it got to the point where it was almost like becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, she'll try and take control of her life again and forget about AA and forget about practicing the program daily, which is what we have to do.
You make an interesting
point.
That's
what I do now.
You make an interesting point, though. All these people, all your friends in recovery, you went along and you were, you know, 2.5 years sober, and then you fell off the wagon, and then you went back, and then you fell off the wagon.
Absolutely.
And you went back, and you fell off the wagon.
Yeah.
And each time, they didn't turn the back. They didn't think, oh, she's a waste of time. Oh, she's... There were no judgments.
Absolutely not. No. And AA will never do that. You know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. You know, at the end of the day, you know, they're an all-inclusive organisation. You know, and for some people, they go to the first meeting, they've hit the rock bottom, and they have, you know, they get it straight away, they get involved, they do the action, they get to meetings, they do service, they do all the things that it tells us to do in order to stay well, and they stay well, and they get it from day one. And others don't, you know, and that was my journey. I didn't get it straight away. It took me a long time. It took me years to get where I am today.
But that doesn't make your recovery any less worthwhile, because you've gone from from being homeless, being basically, you know, as low as you can be, and now 3 years in, solid recovery.
Absolutely.
Well, you know it's working, you know it's all good. That's got to be something to celebrate, hasn't it?
Absolutely something to celebrate, yeah. And of course, you know, the program of AA was there for the taking. It's just, it was Peggy that wasn't ready for it, you know.
Yeah, the program didn't change, but you did.
But I did, yeah. The program has remained the same. What's happened to me is that I've become educated. You know, I've finally, you know, the penny finally dropped. For someone who was such a, you know, who's educated, who had a profession, you know, I was a bit sick when it came to my own recovery.
Like, you know, so many people, like a lot of people.
It was like, you know, I could see everybody, I could sort everybody else out, you know. Just my own.
But when
my
it
own
came
recovery,
to Peggy,
absolutely.
She wouldn't get with the program.
No.
As they say. Well, listen.
No, I kept looking for a loophole.
What is life like now, then, if you were to compare and contrast? Not that, you know, that's important, but what are your days like? And when you wake up, you know, in the morning, you've got a clean day in front of you, a brand
Absolutely.
New piece of paper. Tell me about that feeling.
Happy, joyous and free. Happy, joyous and free. Yeah.
And what about, you know, the point of these conversations, some of the point, is for other people in recovery to listen and share and so on.
Absolutely, yeah.
But there will be people that this conversation reaches who are in the doldrums, who think, I can't do it about this, or I'm too far gone, or why should I want to change?
No.
Or, you know, it's people hopeless. And, of course, there's never such a thing as hopeless. There's always hope.
So what
would you say if someone's listening, perhaps they're eyeing up that glass of wine and thinking, why am I drinking this? Because it's become a habit. Or perhaps they've got the hangover, they're shaking it off, and they're thinking, I wish I didn't feel like this anymore. What would your message to them be, Peggy?
What it would be is reach out, because in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a way out on which we all can absolutely agree. And in in harmony, you know, we can say that we have a solution and we are able to pass the solution on to other people, and then to watch people who we've sponsored and guided, as I have, you know, I've sponsored people, I've guided them through, and it's a highlight of your life that you just don't want to miss. And, you know, there is life without alcohol, and there is nothing that taking a drink will ever make. There's nothing that would be solved or made better by taking a drink. Absolutely. And you need never do it again. And if I can do it from all the, you know, the relapses I had, then anybody can. Just reach out. Reach out to the fellowship.
I think there is that danger, isn't there? People have a go and they fall off the wagon, and then they think, oh, well, perhaps, you know, they're too ashamed to go back, or they think people will look at them funnily.
Yeah.
And the important message, I think, is that no one's going to do that in AA, are they?
Absolutely not. No, no. And everybody's journey is different, you know, and I just thank goodness for the fellowship, because and the fact that it is all inclusive. So whether you get it first time or whether it takes you 10 years, you know, the bottom line is the fellowship is always there for you. And you needn't keep falling off the wagon if you just do as you're told, you know. But like my dad always said to me, you will not be told. You know, I had that streak in me, you know. And you know, I was 50 by the time I went to AA. So I was, you know, well and truly stuck in my own ways. And, you really do have to humble yourself and just get off your high horse and just, you know, swallow the medicine as it's given.
Well, for once, Peggy, you did. Listen,
I did.
Yeah, for once,
and
you
I'm
would
fine
be told.
Now. Yeah, yeah. Eventually, never too old. Never too old to be told.
Tomorrow's the first day of the rest of your life, isn't it, as they say?
Absolutely, yeah.
Peggy, yeah. We ask people in these conversations if there's a song or a particular tune that has any special importance or any special merit for them. Have you chosen one for us?
I have, and it's Ronan Keating, I Hope You Dance. And the reason I choose that is because, for me, it sums up what's on offer if you take the bull by the horns and do the program to the best of your ability. You know, at the end of the day, don't, you know, be humble. Don't take the line of least resistance. Just throw yourself into it. And at the end of it, I hope you dance, because the dancing is like the sobriety. So just listen to the words on that. And that's what it means to me.
I hope you'll never lose your sense of wonder. You get your fill to eat, but always keep that hunger. May you never take one single breath for granted. God forbid love ever leaves you empty-handed. I hope you still feel small when you stand beside the ocean. Whenever one door closes, I hope one more opens. Promise me that you'll give faith a fighting chance. And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance, I hope you dance. I hope you dance. Settle for the path of least resistance. Living might mean taking chances, but they're worth taking. Loving might be a mistake, but it's worth making. Don't let some helping heart leave you bitter. When you come close to selling out, reconsider. Give the heavens above more than just a passing glance. And when you get the choice to sit it out or to dance, I hope you dance. The ocean. Whenever one door closes, I hope one more opens. Promise me that you'll give faith a fighting chance. And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance. I hope you dance.